This is Tamara, returning with the Decatur Herald and Review, August 19th. We continue now with the death notices. Decatur. Catherine Katie G. Bellows, 93 of Decatur, formerly of Streeter, passed away peacefully August 18th in her home surrounded by her twin daughters. Massive Christian burial will be 10 a.m. Monday, August 22nd, at Our Lady of Lourdes in Decatur. Visitation will be from 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Sunday, August 21st, with liturgical prayers recited at 4 p.m. in Moran and Gable Funeral Home. Burial will be in Macon County Memorial Park in Harristown. Memorials may be directed in lieu of flowers to DMH Hospice or Cancer Care Specialists. The family of Katie Bellows is being served by Moran and Gable Funeral Home and Cremation Services, 2801 North Monroe Street, Decatur, Illinois. View the online obituary, send condolences, and share memories to the family at www.moranandgable.com. Hammond. Anna K. Blaha, 81, of rural Amana, passed away Monday, August 15th. Visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. Friday at the Cowboy Church in Walford, where a funeral service will be held 11 a.m. Saturday. An additional time of visitation will be held 10 a.m. Monday at the United Methodist Church in Hammond, where a funeral will start at 11 a.m. and burial will follow at the Hammond Cemetery. Online condolences may be shared with her family at gayandciha.com. Francis Fred Blaudow, Jr., 83, of Arthur, Illinois, passed away at 7:36 p.m. Tuesday, August 16th, at Carl Foundation Hospital in Urbana, Illinois. Funeral services will be held at 6 p.m. on Friday, August 19th, 2016, at Penn Station in Arthur, Illinois. Reverend Kenneth Rader will officiate. Burial with military rites conducted by the Arthur American Legion Post 479 will be held in the Arthur Cemetery. Visitation will be held 2 hours prior to the funeral from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Penn Station in Arthur, Illinois. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the donor's choice. Decatur. Harold Dutch Christie, age 81, went home to the Lord at 9:20 p.m. Wednesday, August 17th, in Fair Havens Christian Home. Services will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 20th, in Calvary Southern Baptist Church, 1833 South Country Club Road. Visitation will be 1 hour before services in the church. Burial will be in North Fork Cemetery. Tanzius Logan Funeral Service and Care is in charge of arrangements. Sign the guest book at tlcelebratingeverylife.com. In lieu of flowers, a donation may be made to Calvary Baptist Church. Decatur. Samuel Cooper, 61, of Decatur, departed this life suddenly on Monday, August 8th. Memorial service, 12 noon, Friday, August 19th, at Walker Funeral Service. This concludes the reading of the death notices for August 19th. We'll return now to news. Chicago police recommend firing 7 cops for false reports. 7 Chicago police officers should be fired for filing false reports in the fatal shooting of black teenager Laquan McDonald in 2014, the police superintendent said Thursday, in a move aimed at repairing the reputation of a department dogged by decades of cover-ups and scandal. The release last year of official police reports that directly contradicted video evidence of McDonald's shooting by a white police officer turned a spotlight on long-standing concerns about a code of silence in Chicago's police force in which officers stay quiet about or conceal possible misconduct by colleagues. Superintendent Eddie Johnson said in a statement Thursday that after reviewing documents, video, and other evidence, he was accepting the recommendation of the city's inspector general to fire 7 officers because of their accounts of the incident. The officers violated Rule 14, which prohibits making a false report, written or oral, said Johnson. He did not name the seven officers. Johnson will take this recommendation to the city's police board, which will make the final decision. The process typically takes about 7 months, so any decision to fire the officers isn't likely until next year. Johnson became the superintendent after Mayor Rahm Emanuel fired Gary McCarthy because of the McDonald shooting video, and his recommendation marks the single biggest decision he has made for a department long dogged by suspicions that it condones or covers up the brutality and misconduct of its officers. Dean Angelo Sr., the head of the Chicago Police Union, defended the officers. He said their interpretation of what unfolded may have been accurate from their perspective, noting that perceptions can be affected in high-stress situations like shootings. "That's what humans go through," he said. "And contrary to popular belief, police officers are human beings." But community activists praised Johnson's announcement, saying the rare move shows he is serious about overhauling department practices. "I think Eddie Johnson gets it. He gets the crisis that we are in now and how to solve it," said Jedediah Brown, a leader of a group called Chicago Life. Thomas Gradle, a co-author of Crime, Corruption, and Cover-Ups in the Chicago Police Department, a 2013 report published by the University of Illinois at Chicago, said the recommendation that so many officers be fired was unprecedented in the city and a step toward real reform. "I don't see how they can change back to the way things were before," he said. Johnson's decision stems from a scene captured on dash cam video, taken in October 2014, in which Officer Jason Van Dyke can be seen firing 16 times at McDonald, including when McDonald was on the ground. The release of the video the next year, on the orders of a judge, sparked days of protests. An investigation of Chicago police practices by the U.S. Justice Department and promises of reforms by Emanuel, who found himself scrambling to restore public confidence in his office and the police force. Prosecutors filed first-degree murder charges against Van Dyke, who has pleaded not guilty. The subsequent release of police reports raised serious questions about the accounts of other officers at the scene, which contradicted what was on the video. As investigations into the incident continued, a judge took the rare step of appointing a special prosecutor to examine the actions of officers who were at the scene. Included among hundreds of documents that the city has released are officers' accounts describing McDonald menacingly advancing on police and waving a knife threateningly at them right before Van Dyke fired. Van Dyke's partner, Joseph Walsh, told an investigator he repeatedly yelled, "Drop the knife," at McDonald and backed up as the teenager advanced at the officers. Further, he supported Van Dyke's claim, saying McDonald swung the knife toward the officers in an aggressive manner and that he believed McDonald was attempting to kill them. Another wrote that Van Dyke, in defense of his life, backpedaled and fired his handgun at McDonald. Multiple officers wrote that, even after McDonald had been shot, he still posed a threat. "McDonald fell to the ground but continued to move and continued to grasp the knife, refusing to let go of it," one report reads. But the video belies those accounts. In it, Van Dyke is seen stepping from a squad car, shooting almost immediately. After one or two shots, McDonald collapses, barely moving except for slight twitches as bullets pummel his body. Court filings by prosecutors say all but a few of the 16 shots hitting McDonald were fired over 13 seconds as he lay in the street. Prosecutors say the 3-inch blade was found folded into the handle. The Inspector General's report centered on the actions of 10 officers, including the 7 whom Johnson says should be dismissed. 2 of the officers cited in the report have since retired. Johnson said he disagrees with the recommendation to fire an 8th officer, saying there was insufficient evidence to prove those respective allegations. Angelo said the 7 officers must rightly wonder if the police board will listen to them defend their actions that night, given months of protests against police in Chicago and other U.S. cities. "How comfortable are you that you are going to get a fair shake?" he said. "No one stands on the side of policing right now." Prosecutors probing allegations judge let clerk sit on bench. Chicago. An Illinois judge and a law clerk who is a few months away from becoming a judge herself are in legal hot water after the judge allegedly let the clerk put on a robe, take the bench, and rule on a couple of minor cases. Chicago's legal community was buzzing on Thursday, a day after Cook County's chief judge issued a brief news release announcing that Circuit Judge Valerie E. Turner had been taken off the bench indefinitely, and law clerk Rhonda Crawford had been suspended from her job without pay. "Nothing like this has ever happened before that I remember, and everybody is talking about it," said Stephen Hunter, a Chicago attorney, who said he's represented people charged with impersonating police officers, but never a judge. Crawford allegedly presided over two traffic cases on August 11th, according to the chief county judge's spokesman. Both cases will return to court before a real judge. Neither Turner nor Crawford returned calls for comment about what happened or why the judge might have allowed the clerk to take her gavel. In politics, Trump says he regrets comments that may have caused pain. From Charlotte, North Carolina. For the first time since declaring his presidential run, Republican Donald Trump acknowledged that his caustic comments may have caused people pain, saying that he regrets some of what he said in the heat of debate. A day after announcing a campaign shakeup, and as he trails in the polls, the GOP nominee said that he recognized that his comments, which have angered minorities and alienated large swaths of the general election electorate, may have been ill-advised. Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that, the GOP nominee, reading from prepared text, said at a rally in Charlotte, North Carolina. And believe it or not, I regret it, and I do regret it, particularly where it may have caused personal pain. He added that too much is at stake for us to be consumed with these issues. As the crowd cheered, Trump pledged to always tell you the truth. The remarks came as Trump was trying to rescue a campaign that has struggled since the Democratic and Republican nominating conventions from a series of self-created distractions. Early Wednesday, Trump announced that he was overhauling his operation, bringing in a new chief executive and appointing a new campaign manager. Rarely do presidential campaigns wait to advertise or undergo such leadership tumult at such a late stage of the general election. Yet Trump has struggled badly in recent weeks to offer voters a consistent message, overshadowing formal policy speeches with a steady stream of self-created controversies, including a public feud with an American Muslim family whose son was killed while serving in the U.S. military in Iraq. Trump's decision to tap Stephen Bannon, a combative conservative media executive, as his new campaign chief suggested to some he planned to double down on the playbook he used in the primary, playing to his angry rally crowds and bouncing from one controversy to the next. Instead, a new Trump emerged on Thursday, a less combative, more inclusive candidate who said he was running to be the voice for every forgotten part of this country that has been waiting and hoping for a better future, and for those who don't hear anyone speaking for them. Earlier Thursday, Trump moved to invest nearly $5 million in the battleground state advertising to address daunting challenges in the states that will make or break his White House ambitions. The New York businessman's campaign reserved television and space over the coming 10 days in Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, according to Kantar Media's political ad tracker, while Democrat Hillary Clinton has spent more than $75 million on advertising in 10 states since locking up her party's nomination. Trump's new investment marks his first of the general election season. Election Day is 81 days away, with early voting in the first states to set to begin in 5 weeks. In his remarks, Trump struck a new, inclusive tone and tried to appeal directly to non-white voters, shown by polls to an overwhelmingly unfavorable view of the candidate. "I will not rest until children of every color in this country are fully included in the American dream," Trump told his audience, again accusing Democratic Hillary Clinton of bigotry. Clinton, he claimed, sees communities of color only as votes and not as human beings worthy of a better future. He urged African American voters to give him a chance, saying, "What do you have to lose by trying something new?" Clinton's campaign, meanwhile, brushed the speech off as just words he read from a teleprompter. Donald Trump literally started his campaign by insulting people. He has continued to do so through each of the 428 days from then until now, without shame or regret, said spokesman Christina Reynolds in a statement. We learned tonight that his speechwriter and teleprompter knows he has much for which he should apologize, but that apology tonight is simply a well-written phrase until he tells us which of his many offensive, bullying, and divisive comments he regrets and changes his tune altogether, she said. It remains to be seen whether Trump's reboot comes too late and whether he has the discipline to maintain it. Trump now trails Clinton in preference polls of most key battleground states, and his party leaders, even at the Republican National Committee, have already conceded they may divert resources away from the presidential contest in favor of vulnerable Senate and House candidates if things don't improve. But Trump supporters largely accepted the change of tone, even if some saw it as unnecessary. It takes a lot of strength to say I'm sorry, to admit, not that he was wrong, but he wished he hadn't done it, said Cindy Ammons, 70, a Trump supporter from Spindale, North Carolina. I think he's evolving, she said. Now a bit of sports. With the Fighting Illini, McLaughlin rises to top for kicking job. Champaign. At Illini training camp this month, there's been an understandable quest to learn more about Illinois' new coaching staff, various position battles, and the health of a team that seems to get more physical every day. In the process, there's been very little focus on a player who could win a game with a swift swing of his right foot. Meet Chase McLaughlin, who's been running number one in the competition to be Illinois' new field goal kicker. McLaughlin is not a newcomer to the program. This is his third season with the team, although he's yet to appear in a game. The Houston native was a high school football and soccer player who decided to market himself to colleges and contacted the University of Illinois via email. As it turned out, former offensive line coach A.J. Ricker, himself a native of nearby Katy, Texas, was recruiting in the state and came by to meet McLaughlin. While no scholarship was offered, McLaughlin decided to enroll and join the team as a walk-on in the summer of 2014. He redshirted that season and watched as Taylor Zalewski converted 16 of the 25 field goals Illinois attempted last season. Zalewski also kicked off 58 times last season, with David Reisner booting the other two. With Zalewski now gone, a training camp competition has been waged for three special teams kicking jobs: field goal kicker, kickoff specialist, and punter. McLaughlin has the lead for the field goal job, although he does not take that outcome for granted. Reisner is the favorite to handle kickoffs, while Ryan Frayne looks to be the punter. But as McLaughlin knows, a kicker's job is never safe, even if his name was the only one head coach Lovie Smith singled out during Sunday's media day briefing. That was a good sign, and my parents were definitely happy about it because they were watching the whole thing live on FightingIllini.com from Houston, McLaughlin said. But I didn't read too much into it because I know one day it could be me and one day it could be someone else. McLaughlin is being evaluated by a new special teams coach, Bob Legeski, who has coached special teams for seven different NFL teams. He's trying to focus on what we do best and how to make that better, McLaughlin said. He doesn't try to change too much. He sees what our strong points are and finds a way to improve them. McLaughlin's strong point is getting the ball elevated quickly and getting his kick launched under the posted goal of 1.3 seconds from the time the ball moves from the center and meets the kicker's foot. I get the ball up quick, which means there's less chance for it to be blocked, McLaughlin said, and my times have been consistently good. What about distance? Distance isn't as important as accuracy, McLaughlin said, because most kicks are going to be in that 35 to 45 range. But on a neutral day, no wind or rain, I feel comfortable I can make a kick in the mid to high 50s. McLaughlin knows he will keep his number one standing as long as his accuracy remains solid. Mentally zoning in on every kick is kind of hard because you start thinking about your form and technique instead of just putting it through the uprights. That's what it comes down to. McLaughlin also works on his kickoffs, but Lovie Smith said he has no problem splitting those duties. The most accurate guy will be our field goal kicker, he said. The guy with the strongest leg will kick off for us. There are a lot of punters who kick off, so we have options. I like what Chase McLaughlin has done. Punting-wise, I think we're solid. One area we'll continue to work on is our return specialists. We need someone to step up in that role so we can use it as a weapon. Smith's view of the return game is somewhat jaded since he coached arguably the best in NFL history, Devin Hester, with the Chicago Bears. Smith said he has yet to uncover the next Devin Hester. To find someone to replace the greatest returner in the history of the NFL, that's pretty hard, he said. We'll have someone we can put back there who can give us some production. Notes: NFL scouts have been at practice on most days, and more were there on Friday. Their immediate focus seems to be on the defensive line, where defensive end Dewan Smoot draws much attention. Among the teams represented Friday were the Chicago Bears, Atlanta Falcons, and Carolina Panthers. The defensive line will draw the scouts in, and that only helps some of the players that they don't know about. We have an open practice. We encourage them to come in. It makes our practice better when our players know that people who could be their employer are watching every move they make. It's been good, Smith said. From the Olympics, sidelines. Relay rerun. All by themselves on the massive track, the four U.S. women took their positions in lane two. Tiana Bartoletta kneeled into the blocks and waited for the starter's pistol. It sounded and away she went, alone, in a first-of-its-kind Olympic relay race against the clock. The Americans won that contest Thursday night to earn their spot in the final eight of the 4x100. As is the case with so many relays in the U.S. has run over the years, this was anything but routine. Our coach told us before we went out there, it's just like practice, just the whole world will be watching, said English Gardner. Returning to the track 7.5 hours after they left, the team of Bartoletta, Allison Felix, Gardner, and Morilake Akinason finished in a time of 41.77 seconds to bump China out of the last spot in the final. The rerun of their preliminary heat came about after Felix, running in the second position, got jostled by a Brazilian, stumbled, and tried, unsuccessfully, to flip the baton ahead to Gardner. The stick fell, and after being disqualified, the Americans lodged a successful protest. But unlike some races, in which an additional runner could simply be added to the final, relays are limited to 8 teams because there are only 8 lanes that wrap completely around the track. So the judges brought the Americans back to run in the same lane, in the same order, in what USA Track and Field said was the first rerun of its kind in Olympic history. Bryant wreaks havoc on Brewers. Chicago. Chris Bryant came to the plate in the 8th inning a couple shy of the cycle. The club Cubs slugger was trying for a little more. My last at bat I was thinking home run, Bryant said. There aren't too many games you can hit 3 home runs. Bryant settled for an RBI single to cap a 5-for-5 day with 2 homers, a double, and 5 RBIs. He helped Chicago overcome a career-high 7 walks by Jake Arrieta to beat the Milwaukee Brewers 9-6 Thursday for a 4-game sweep. Motorsports. Racers power through difficult loss of Clausen. The four-wheeled circus rolls into the area to take control of 3 local dirt tracks, but the ringleader is missing. Brian Clausen, the 27-year-old star of open-wheel dirt track racing, died earlier this month following a midget crash at the USAC Belleville, Kansas Nationals. A native of Northern California and a resident of Noblesville, Indiana, Clausen was popular for his talent and interaction with the fans. But perhaps most of all, his racing rivals just miss Clausen. His friendly personality and fiancée Lauren Stewart, not to mention those 2 little dogs that traveled with them everywhere. This is a weekend that favored diversity shown by Clausen. The Power Lucas Oil Midget Series races at Lincoln Speedway today and Macon Speedway on Saturday. In sharp contrast to those short tracks, many of the same drivers head to the USAC Tony Bettenhausen 100 Saturday for Silver Crown Cars, and the ARCA SuperChevyStores.com 100 Sunday for the stock cars on the Springfield Mile at the Illinois State Fairgrounds. I've known Brian since we raced quarter midgets against each other, said Power Series points leader Zach Dom of Pocahontas. We were probably 8 to 10 years old. He was such an ambassador for our racing and racing in general. He ran the Indy 500, for God's sake. That's the biggest thing you can do. We just don't know how to take this. He was the best of our generation. Clausen was a big winner. He already earned 2 USAC National Sprint Car Championships and 2 USAC National Midget Championships. He also won the prestigious Chili Bowl midget race in 2014, known as the Sports Super Bowl, and racked up more than 170 feature wins in his career. Clausen was a big winner. I've got to do a lot of cool stuff, Clausen said before a race at Jacksonville Speedway last spring. I started the Indy 500 twice. I've been on the pole at Daytona for the NASCAR Xfinity race. I've won the Chili Bowl. All I've wanted to do was be a sprint car driver. I had a good time when I was down in Charlotte doing NASCAR stuff. It's more like a job. The sprint car stuff is a lot of fun. If that's all I do for the rest of my career, then there's no shame in that. A memorial is scheduled for Wednesday at Kokomo, Indiana Speedway, where Clausen won the feature event hours after racing in the Indy 500 this summer. This is truly one of the darkest days in the 60-year history of the United States Auto Club, USAC CEO Kevin Miller told USA Today, when news of Clausen's death was released to the public. Clausen's fiancée, Lauren Stewart, is from Jacksonville, one reason why he enjoyed trips to central Illinois. Drivers from other series are also honoring Clausen. Danica Patrick worked Clausen's souvenir trailer last weekend at the Knoxville, Iowa Nationals. Tony Stewart paid $32,000 in a benefit auction for Clausen's favorite helmet, then returned it to Lauren Stewart. Drivers know this is serious business, even at short tracks where the speeds don't rival the backstretch at Daytona or the front straightaway at Indy. So it's full speed ahead. Dom will race in the midgets in the Bettenhausen 100. Dom and the Keith Coons racing team, owned by the Springfield native, are powerhouses in the midget races. Toyota wants us to win the Powery Championship, Dom said. They hire Keith Coons to do USAC and me to do POWRI. At the end of the day, we both need to win those championships for them and for ourselves. Dom already won the MOWA sprint car race at Macon Speedway in July, and he knows the way around the high-banked fifth-mile track. Lincoln Speedway is a quarter-mile fairgrounds track with sweeping turns. Tanner Thorson, who ranks second in the POWRI standings, is scheduled to run all four races after announcing a deal to pilot an ARCA stock car this weekend. That's how Clausen would have liked it. From the Decatur Tribune, Osborne Online. Back when the work ethic was taught by example. My father lived through the Great Depression when jobs were scarce, pay was low, and he and my mother were barely able to get by during a very difficult time. However, what I did notice, even though I didn't know what to call it at that time, was his work ethic. Maybe it was because my dad, and so many like him, knew from experience how hard life was without a job, and that created a deep awareness of the value of work. When I was growing up, my dad rarely missed a day of work, and he was never late to his job, because he always left home to allow plenty of time to arrive safely before starting. His work ethic was to give his employer an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. I know from observation that Dad went to work many days when he was sick, but he couldn't imagine staying away from his job. Dad spent most of his working years at Caterpillar in Decatur, and when he retired, he had risen through the ranks from the shop in Peoria to supervisor of planning at the local plant. Apparently, hard work wasn't harmful to my father. He lived to enjoy life and retirement well into his 90s, and certainly taught my brother Sam and myself, by example, about what the work ethic could do for us. We don't have an unemployment problem. We have an unemployable problem. That's the challenge for Grow Decatur. The problem has been defined. The solution is the tough nut to crack. I also realize that we have many unemployed due to circumstances beyond their control, and they are not the subject of this column. Work ethic is defined as a belief in the moral benefit and importance of work and its inherent ability to strengthen character. I was blessed to have a father who understood that it took work to build a life for himself and his family. If we lose them, either through seeing more opportunities in other communities or failing to have the work ethic to prosper and succeed here, we're in serious trouble. Decatur has an abundance of organizations and people who are helping and who want to help, those who are looking for the opportunity to work and build their lives. Our city will become all that it can be when work is no longer a dirty four-letter word, but a way for a person and community to be successful. I guess it must seem old-fashioned to write it, but there really is no substitute for work in building a successful life and community. This has been Tamara reading the Decatur Herald and Review, August 19th. I look forward to reading with you again soon.